Welcome to Topple Uncaged. I'm Steve Topple, and over the next 20 minutes, I'll be bringing you the quickest firing news roundup of the week. I'll be getting down and dirty with a very special guest going through some big stories. I'll be taking a part of this week's Question Time, and also I'll be bringing you some of the biggest, most banging political tunes going. So, lock and load, people. Let's go.
Uncaged.
This track is not an attack upon the American people. It's an attack upon the system within which they live. Since 1945, the United States has attempted to overthrow more than 50 foreign governments. In the process, the US has caused the end of life for several million people and condemned many millions more to a life of agony and despair. The strength of your dream and prevents you from reason. The American.
What's up, everyone? I am Steve Topple. It is Sunday, the 3rd of February, and that can only mean one thing. It is this week's edition of Topple Uncaged. Yes, that is, of course, Loki with his track Abomination from 2010. Oh my, how little things have changed. I think 2019 is going to be the year where the trend is going to be Western-backed coups. We already have chaos in Venezuela. Syria is still bubbling away under the surface. There is looking more and more like something is developing in Sudan. The Central African Republic is burning and quietly simmering away as a situation in Papua New Guinea. But of course, the common denominator with all these things is they are backed by the US and its Western allies. Now, we used to call this Western imperialism. I think to bring it back up to date, it needs to be called corporatist imperialism. Because that is essentially what it is. Nothing has changed since 1954 and the Guatemalan coup on behalf of the United Fruit Company. But when people are politically stuck between a punch from the left and a sucker punch from the right, it is ultimately the poorest in society who end up suffering. And no one has got their best interests at heart. Loki, you said very prophetically in 2010,
the world's entertainer, the world's devastator, from Venezuela to Mesopotamia.
As always on this week's show, I'll be bringing you the quickest news roundup in the UK. I'll be going in on three top stories with a very special guest. I will be ripping apart this week's rancid Question Time, and I've got an international music sensation who has come back with a bang. Let's see if we can get the show done without another country falling to the corporations. The fastest news segment in the UK, it's Plucked News. My, how time flies. Yes, it's that time of the week again. It is Plucked News. 5 news stories, 5 minutes. Can I fit them all in? Of course I can. If you're ready, we'll get going straight away. In one, I'm off to Disability News Service and my mate John Pring, and he reported that Capita closes PIP claim after woman complains about use of 25-year-old report. This is a staggering story from Northern Ireland of the case of Mary, her name has been changed, who had a personal independence payment assessment via Capita. Now, the Capita person assessing her used a 25-year-old medical report on her, which of course her circumstances and her medical conditions had changed. The thrust of this is, when she raised her concerns in the actual assessment, the nurse was fine, said, oh no, that's not a problem, of course, we'll look for new information. But of course, in reality, this is not what happened, and the DWP closed her case after Capita complained that she had been aggressive and non-compliant during the assessment. What's the point of this story? Trust me, this is not a one-off. This is the hostile environment that the Conservative Party and New Labour before them have created with the DWP and the outsourcing of it to private companies. Mary wasn't being unreasonable, she was just simply raising concerns, which the nurse, because Mary recorded the whole assessment, good for her, the nurse said she agreed with her and that Mary was just being reasonable and to the point. Again, the problem with this is not an isolated case. Capita and the other people who run these PIP and ESA assessments are notoriously nefarious. And people wonder why disabled people live in fear of the Department for Work and Pensions. You are absolutely obnoxious. The DWP, its attitudes and its whole operations do not need reform. It needs a root and branch review. The whole thing needs raising to the ground and starting again, because this is now beyond a joke. Speaking of being beyond a joke, I'm off to story number two, and it is BBC News, and they reported that equal pay adds to losers' appeal in court case. This is rancid Asda, owned by American company Walmart, of course, who are desperately trying to overturn a decision by an employment tribunal about equal pay for men and women. Essentially, the thrust of the story is that women who work on the shop floor in their supermarkets, stacking shelves and operating at the tills, are paid less than men who work in warehouses, moving products around and filling up lorries. An employment tribunal originally said that they could not see the difference between the work that women do in the shop floor and the work that the men do in the warehouse. Therefore, they should all be paid the same. Asda, the bunch of corporatist bastards, have of course been appealing this at every turn. Basically saying, it's complex legal issues. No, it bloody isn't. You're essentially paying men more than women to do some of the dirty work in both your stores and your warehouses. But of course, this is typical corporatist capitalism, because basically, Asda does not want to pay out more money. Oh yes, we hear all the time about the glass ceiling being smashed for women. It don't work when you're at the bottom of society, guys, I'm afraid. As the situation with Asda shows, they literally do not give a shit, but it's of course the corporatist way. And I'm staying with BBC News for story number 3, and they reported that ban phones in school, says Minister Nick Gibb. Here we go, more Conservative Party policy living in the dark ages. This is Schools Minister Nick Gibb saying that mobile phones should not be allowed to be taken into schools, and he was hoping that head teachers would agree and follow suit. Oddly enough, some head teachers do not agree with this. One was quoted as saying that, of course, they're very useful for learning, but this is completely missing the point. We're not in Victorian times, Gibb. Unfortunately, you've opened a genie's bottle here with capitalism, that most children now have smartphones, and of course the implications for that are that parents are now in communication with their children to and from school, which is crucially important. We can't undo this, we can't unsee it. Smartphones are here to stay. Now, there's an argument for whether they should be allowed into lessons or not. Like at my stepson's school, his mobile phone is put into a locker at the start of the day and he can take it out at the end of it. That's down to teachers. But children should be allowed to carry mobile phones to and from school. It is important. But moreover, Nick Gibb, moaning about the distractions of the internet and social media, it's only a distraction because of the way capitalism utilises it to entice children in to its corporatist advertising and trying to get them to purchase all manner of products and play on games all the time. Not that our education system will train children to use the internet and social media properly, that is to seek out the truth, connect with other people, and hopefully organise a global revolution in the process. But Gibb, if you had your way, we'd all go back to the workhouses anyway, wouldn't we? Story number 4, and I'm off to The Guardian, and they reported that Leave.eu and Arron Banks insurance firm fined £120,000 for data breaches. This is the Information Commissioner's Office, a regulatory body into data in this country, fining Leave.eu, one of the campaign groups over Brexit, £120,000 for essentially using information that Arron Banks had from one of his insurance companies and sending people out political targeted messaging. Now, God, this story goes on and on and on and on and on about possible breaches of this, that and the other during the EU referendum and how Brexit was swayed by all this extra marketing and nicking people's details, which wasn't really allowed. And anyway, never mind £120,000 fine for Leave.eu. If Tory election fraud had been investigated properly and people actually charged, then the whole 2015 election, which was the most skewed in British history, would be put into question. And it was, of course, that which led us to the EU referendum anyway. £120,000? This isn't changing anything. It's a failure of the establishment and capitalism and neoliberalism which has truly screwed us over. And finally, I'm back home to the Canary and my mate Joshua Funnell, and he reported that Streatham Labour just gave Chukwuman a people's vote, but it wasn't the one he wanted. Apart from the hilarity of seeing Chukwuman as shit himself, and the overriding irony in this situation, which is of course hilarious, this is a story about Streatham Constituency Labour Party voting overridingly to allow members to have a vote on everything. Essentially, they've adopted an all-member meeting system which allows all members to vote to decide on local Labour policy. Now, this is of course the thrust of what Jeremy Corbyn wants overall, that every single member has a say in policy that Labour Party takes forward nationally. But we're seeing it on a local level in Streatham. Why is this important? Firstly, because the bitterites are in an absolute twist over it. But moreover, it shows that Jeremy Corbyn's democratic reforms, where he wants everyone to be engaged with processes in the Labour Party, are now filtering down to local CLP level. This could make a massive difference in councils like Streatham, Lewisham, Lambeth, where the people running the show are notoriously centrist and often make decisions which are terrible for local constituents. All power to Streatham CLP. You go get them, guys. And I'm sure Chooker will be crying all over his Dom Perignon. Boo bloody who. And having the time to mention my mate Potent Whisper, rapper, poet and conscious spoken word artist, releasing a track specifically for the Standard 15 who are facing jail over blocking deportation flights. They're up on terrorism charges. This is absolutely ridiculous, of course. But this is a great track. You really should check it out. The link is in the show notes, and there's also a link to my mate Emily Apple's brilliant article on it. Nor have I time to mention my mate Streets Kitchen, who are setting up a brilliant solidarity centre, a shelter for homeless people, in Islington in North London. This is groundbreaking work they're doing because it's in conjunction with the council, so please, once again, link in the show notes, go and check out what they're up to, and if you can help, get down there. Going from the sublime to the ridiculous, nor have I even time to mention the man who was fined £90 for refusing to show his face in the trial of facial recognition technology by the Met Police. If you think this is a non-story, think again. This is the shape of things to come. Creeping, creeping, creeping authoritarianism under the Conservative Party. And we moan about countries like Venezuela. I must also give a shout out and send rest in power condolences to Jeremy Hardy, the British comedian who died aged 57. This guy was an outrider, especially considering he was on BBC Radio 4, in terms of his political wit, satire and ability to take apart the Conservative Party. This guy was a genius. There will be a link in the show notes to some of his work. Rest in power, Jeremy. Going from a genius to an absolute dickhead, I didn't even have time to talk about Uri Geller, spoon-bending idiot and friend of the late Michael Jackson, saying he was going to use his telepathic powers to make sure Corbyn didn't get in as Prime Minister. Please. Is your bank balance running a bit empty? Is that why you need to get yourself on some front pages? Go and shove your bended spoons right up your arse. But thinking about that, have Yuri Gillis' powers been working? Because I haven't even had time to talk about Jeremy Corbyn out on the campaign trail this week when he was raising awareness about the dire state of public transport in this country. Ironically, the bus he was trying to get didn't even show up. I don't think this is really Yuri Gillis' telepathic powers. I think it's more that the privatisation and corporatisation of public transport in this country has left us so screwed that even when the Labour leader is out, he can't get a ride anywhere. One bus not turning up, I imagine then two came along at once. And that's it for Puck News this week. However, we are going straight into dissecting this week's top stories. It's me, Free Flying With. My guest on this week's Free Flying With is a very special friend of mine. She is a superb writer. She's also a damn fine editor at The Canary. She's one of my canary chirpers. It is the fabulous, the exemplary, the unmatchable Emily Apple, who is a legend in so many ways. Emily, thank you so much for coming on this week's podcast.
Oh, thank you very much. I don't think I can live up to that introduction, but thank you.
Ah, that was tame, Emily. That was tame to your true capabilities. Okay, so as usual with Free Flying With, we have three stories to get through. Cracking straight on, Emily, we are going into the latest scandal surrounding Rough Sleepers, and as our mutual friend and canary chirper, Freya Lockley, reported, the Rough Sleeping figures have come out, and they've shown a 2% drop in Rough Sleeping. The Conservative Party were over this. There was some odious Tory MP on Question Time on Thursday declaring this as some sort of revelation and showing what they're doing working. But of course it doesn't detract from the fact that Rough Sleeping initially increased by 169% since 2010, so it means it's only dropped to 165%. So Emily, there's two angles I want to look at within this story of the new figures of Rough Sleeping that's come out. First one is a particular bugbear of mine, and I know it's a bugbear of a lot of charities, but also grassroots homelessness organisations. That is, this Rough Sleeping figure that they miraculously come to, it is essentially done by a group of people going out in each metropolitan district or each council area on one given night in November and counting how many Rough Sleepers they see. Any logical person would look at that and think, well, if they're counting them on one night, there's probably going to be a lot more. But this has never changed. What's your take on this appalling way of counting Rough Sleepers?
They have to have a figure. They don't really care. But anyone can see that's a ridiculous way of doing it. You're never going to get accurate figures that way. You're never going to get the actual true number of Rough Sleepers. They're not taking into account any of the other factors that might influence how many Rough Sleepers there are on that particular night. Most major charities say that these figures significantly underestimate the number of Rough Sleepers. So even by the government's calculation of they're doing a tiny bit better, even though they've done huge damage over the last 5 years, and they've got the number down, I think it was by 74 or something like that.
Hey!
I know, yay! Go Tories! Yeah, Communities Secretary James Brockenshire said, it's, you know, their strategies are starting to have an effect. Wow, fantastic. Thank you.
No, absolutely, of course. One last point on this. The real issue with homelessness and Rough Sleeping is that since Ken Loach made Cathy Come Home, and I think it was 1966 when he brought the issue of homelessness and housing crises in this country to the fore, we still haven't solved the problem. Are we ever going to solve this issue, Emily, unless we actually address the fundamentals of the way we as a species govern and regulate and structure ourselves as societies?
That's a massive question. I think it's not solvable under capitalism or neoliberal policies. It's solvable if we move to a more democratic, more equitable system that isn't based on private ownership, isn't based on greed, isn't based on facilitating a few people to have loads while everyone has nothing. And isn't based even on the sort of people who have, you know, a few buy-to-let properties here and there. You know, it's a system that doesn't sell off council houses, that actually invests in communities, that actually wants people to prosper and do well and have fulfilling lives and not be cogs in a capitalist machine, just sort of trying to keep it all going so that the rich keep getting richer. So it does. It's going to take a revolution or a complete different way of thinking about things, but I think it is possible. I don't think we have to be like this. I don't think it's inherent in our species, but it's going to take a lot more than sort of tweaking around the edges to make it happen.
that conclusion brings us quite nicely, Emily, into our next topic, which is we're back to Universal Credit. This is a story I wrote this week, which is about a young man called Charlie, who the DWP and Amber Rudd decided to get in a video promoting Universal Credit, where he was extolling the virtues of how wonderful the new benefit, which rolls six old ones into one, how wonderful it is. Of course, the lovely Alex Tiffin, who runs the Universal Credit Sufferer website, as he exposed and I then wrote about, this Charlie was no ordinary claimant. He was basically a bit part actor who did TV adverts. He also seemed to be jetting off, judging by his Instagram, on foreign holidays every year, apart from in 2015. And the argument around this was the fact that this Charlie, he is not representative of Universal Credit. He's about as far removed from representation as you can get. What I'd like to sort of briefly get into, because we do discuss Universal Credit a lot on this podcast, so we don't need to discuss it that much. What, Emily, as an activist, which you are a outstanding one at that, what as an activist do you think we now need to be doing to try and either mitigate Universal Credit as best as possible or to try and stop it altogether? What can we do?
Well, I think that there's sort of two parts to that in terms of us stopping it. We've tried lots of different things. A general election isn't likely. We have to start taking direct action. We have to start making sure that the government cannot ignore all these people. We need to be out obstructing their infrastructures. We need to be in their way. We need to make sure it is seen, it is heard, and that they're not going to be able to get away with it. We also need to think about things like general strikes. There's a lot of people working and in unions who are on Universal Credit. And on the other flip side of that, because it is happening to people we know, is the stuff that we can do in our communities just to help people and support people, and that direct solidarity, whether it's helping to advocate for people who've got problems, whether it's sort of community-based solutions, cooperative schemes for growing produce and distributing produce, food banks, community kitchens, you know, whatever we can do to help ourselves. Because I think one of the other things that we need to be doing more and more is building our own alternatives so we can say, yeah, fuck this shit. This isn't working. But look, this is how we can do it. And then you're putting those structures in place of how things can be different as well. So I think it's that kind of twofold approach from my point of view.
For me, Emily, the key is Universal Credit could be a little spark that could light a bit more of a fire. Because as you say, the figures are about 3 million workers are going to be on this. This should kick the trade unions into action. But moreover, in communities, it will bridge that divide that has been eroded by the Conservative Party and mainstream media over the past 10, 15 years of between workers and claimants. And I think if we're very clever and if communities come together and organise along with activist groups and trade unions in the correct way, this could turn round to bite the Tories on the arse, because this agenda of claimant and worker, which they've so pushed over the past few years of scroungers, claimant scroungers, that doesn't actually exist under Universal Credit. You're all the same scroungers. Coming on to our final story, this is, of course, the ongoing Spy Cops inquiry. Now, for the listeners at home, Emily, you are intricately involved in this. This is a very personal situation to you, which I know you're not adverse to discussing. Bring our listeners up to speed with regards to the public inquiry. What are the latest developments? What are the latest contentious issues with this, for starters? Where are we at to date?
Okay, well, I'll start in terms of disclosure. I'm what's called a core participant in the inquiry. So I'm one of the people who've got a vested interest in the inquiry because I was spied on, and I knew several of the undercover police officers who are also involved in the inquiry. We were always told the inquiry started in 2015. We have had years of police anonymity applications, of police obstructing justice, of police obstructing anyone trying to get any information whatsoever and using every delaying tactic going. Finally got to the point now where we were supposed to start having evidence hearings in 2019. In June 2019, the evidence hearings were supposed to start. Now, this means that us core participants were supposed to get disclosure packs, which are supposed to contain all the information that the police hold on us. And it's also the start of us being able to question the police's narrative. Now, Judge Mitting, who's running the inquiry, very nice chap, he is. Garrett Club, a bit known for his sexism, doesn't quite fit institutional sexism, let alone institutional racism. He's now delayed the evidence hearings until at least 2020.
Right.
So that's another year. Helen Steele, who was tricked into a relationship with one of these officers, she is representing herself at court. She told the court yesterday at a hearing about privacy issues about the massive distress that this is causing to victims of police spying, because we're waiting for thousands of documents about us and not knowing what they're going to say. So I have disclosure from the public order unit for my domestic extremism files, and just those sort of 3, 4, 5 maybe pages of details of my life are quite distressing, and they're not in any detail.
Yeah.
Mitting then turned round to her and said, there will not be anything about your personal life in the reporting. But we know from Kate Wilson, another woman who was deceived, that there's reams of pages about her personal life. Then we've got the fact that one of the key demands that we had was that the inquiry release the names of all the groups it was spied on. Now, Mitting's made this distinction in his head, basically, between groups that were infiltrated and groups that were spied on.
Right.
The groups that were infiltrated are the targets of the policing operation. So, for example, Jason Bishop, who spied on us, one of his targets would have been the Disarmed Dicey group that I was part of organising protests against the arms fair. That gets listed. But any groups where, so for example, he went to various anarchist meetings and stuff like that, I can name lots of meetings that he was at, aren't listed as groups that he was involved in. It's kind of like...
What?
And so it's like this collateral damage thing of kind of like, well, that wasn't the main target, so we're not going to release the name of that group. It's kind of like, it's just like this massive abuse of human rights, of privacy, of our right to freedom of speech, even in the fact that these officers, it doesn't matter whether that was their target or not. The fact is they went to all these meetings and they kept files on them. There's 40 million pages of statements and evidence from spy cops. I mean, this is going back to 67. And it is just ridiculous. It's too unwieldy to go through all these groups. Now, the argument that he's missing or deliberately ignoring is that if these cops were going to these groups and the only purpose was to get closer to another group or move further along the chain of what they were infiltrating, fine. Not fine, but that, you know, if you take that at face value, then why are there detailed reports of, I went to this meeting, these people were here, these people were speaking. They've made those notes. They filed those reports. So it wasn't just collateral intrusion because they've become police files.
Yeah, exactly. And that is the point. But... like I say, it staggers me. It's quite beyond belief the way this is coming out. And as we said off air, and as I said to you beforehand, my big question always is, okay, so this is what they're letting us know. What the hell has been going on, really, that there's not even come to the public domain yet. But do you think these constant delaying tactics, the constant disregard for victims, is this by design? I mean, are we seeing an intentional attempt to dumb down this inquiry and disparage and if you like, beat down as well? Because this is effectively what they're doing with the victims and people who are subject to this. They're constantly emotionally beating you down at every term. Is this intentional?
It certainly feels like it. And I think it is from the part of the police, because what the police would like more than anything else is if all us core participants dropped out of the inquiry. And for many of us, the reason that we're still in it is because we know that, and we're not going to give them that satisfaction, because that's why we're doing it. I mean, Mitting has no excuses. Lots of us core participants had meetings with Mitting in the last sort of couple of months. And he heard so many stories of the pain this has caused, of the mental health impacts, of people, representations from people who were spied on in the 60s and 70s, who are now in their 70s or 80s. You might not be alive. You know, some of them are ill. They might not be alive in time to give evidence, and how he's going to deal with that. He's heard really emotional speeches and input from us, from people whose children you know, have died from family justice campaigners. And he's sat there and looked like he's taken it in, and then comes to hearings and it's like nothing's ever been said, that none of that emotional distress counts for anything, that it's just, you know, it's just a little fly to be swatted away for him. And it just feels like he is doing everything he can to make the inquiry as narrow as possible, to not get to the truth, and to not deliver any kind of justice whatsoever.
We discussed off air, we might come back and do a full podcast about this, because I think your narrative is extremely important and your insights on this extremely important. If you haven't, everyone listening to this, you really should check out Emily's work on this at the Canary. If you search for the topic spy cops, it's all one word, you can find all Emily's work on this topic. But we will come back to this at a later stage. But for the minute, Emily, thank you so much for joining me, my first Canary chirper to come on Top of Uncaged. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been a real pleasure, Emily. Taking down this week's BBC QT, it's question time. Topple chirps back. Don't panic! Don't panic! Have you been stockpiling your Brexit rice and Brexit pasta? Well, if you believe the women in the question time audience this week, then I suggest you start doing it. Look, I mean, all this scaremongering about stockpiling, I'm not 100% convinced by it. I think it's shock doctrine tactics, as Naomi Klein described in her 2007 book, trying to scare the population into thinking that a catastrophe awaits us, when in fact loads of shit is going on under the surface that no one is talking about. If I'm wrong, I will hold my hands up, but we will wait and see. Otherwise, it was another mundane issue of question time, but let's see what they've got for me. First question, please.
Are you prepping for a no-deal Brexit? And have you any advice on what to stockpile?
The only thing I'm stockpiling is pitchforks and burning torches. Next.
What do the government plan to do to tackle the problem of homelessness and the increasing number of desperate people we see living on the streets of our towns and cities?
As I discussed with Emily Apple on this week's podcast, this is not a problem just for the Tories. This is a problem of our system in its entirety, capitalism and the hierarchy that we live under. And as Emily quite rightly pointed out, until we solve those issues, then we are never going to solve the problem of homelessness. But there's one important point we didn't make on that, and it is that the Tories essentially do buy into this system. Therefore, for them, homelessness is not a problem that needs to be eradicated. It is something where there are acceptable levels of homelessness. They don't plan on eradicating rough sleeping entirely, because it's just part of the way we all live. Some people are destined to be rich, some people are destined to be on the streets. That is their worldview, and I think there's something that we all need to be extremely aware of. Final question, please.
For better or worse, should Western powers try to interfere with Venezuela's current political climate?
Well, funnily enough, the answer to that from me is a resounding no. But there's a deeper issue at play here. Maduro, for what lots of people say in my timeline, is not some left-wing messiah. He is, in a lot of respects, a very naughty boy. However, replacing him with more corporatist, capitalist, neoliberal-esque policies, that is only going to make matters worse. And this is challenged with this whole situation. People are stuck between a rock and a hard place. Maduro isn't perfect, things aren't great, so therefore the people in Venezuela need a change from him. What they don't need is more corporatist imperialism. In my opinion, until people of all political persuasions, that includes people on the left on my Twitter timeline, get their heads around the fact that there is no correct answer to this at the minute, and that we need to start embracing full communitarianism, where societies locally govern themselves, make themselves sustainable, and we have true democracy, where every person decides what happens in the communities, and there is no one group of people in charge, then this shit will just go on and on and on and on forever, much like Question Time does. Now, if I was in the Question Time audience on Thursday, there's a few questions I would like to ask the panel, please. Firstly, does anyone know what happened to the real Gina Miller, the pro-EU anti-Brexit campaigner? Because judging from her performance on Question Time, I don't think it was the real her. Secondly, I'd like to ask that with Trump tweeting about the polar vortex and saying that it essentially shows global warming isn't happening, why hasn't someone taken his Twitter account off him yet? And finally, I would also like to ask, the mass anti-government protests we're currently seeing in Sudan and the effective uprising of the people, is anyone actually going to call this out for what it is? The beginnings of a Western-backed coup? No? No one? Tumbleweed? Mark my words, in a year's time, that's exactly what we'll be looking back and seeing it for. Otherwise, that's it's question time. I so look forward to next week. And here's this week's banger in Revolutionary Birdsong. Now, regular listeners to this show will know that I like to have on musical guests who kind of push the boundaries, as it were, really breaking out into different musical genres. However, my next guest hasn't broken out into new musical genres. He's kind of created one of his own. He has got this stunning EP out, which is just mind-blowingly out there, and it's such a unique sound. I'm not sure where to begin with it, but I'm going to try and begin, because my next guest, as I say, is the legend. Lots of you will know him for various tracks, but it's a legend that's Callie P is only on my podcast. Thank you so much for joining me.
Respect, respect. Blessings, young man, King. Glad to be here, you know? Oh, more.
It's so great to have you on here. So you have released this EP, which has got four tracks on it. Musically, it's like, I'm not sure where to begin. There's influences of trap, which for UK listeners, they would know it as drill. There's loads of hip hop stuff going on. There's obviously reggae. The main sort of focus of that is the bubble pattern, which you're hearing throughout the EP as well. There's dub influences mixed in there. And then even on one of the tracks, Baddest, I'm getting like some Middle East and shit going on there, Cali P. I'm hearing like a Mizmar in the background. It's absolutely stunning. It's just amazing what you've managed to do. So, and it's quite a progression, if you like, from sort of you back in the day, which a lot of people will know you for, Unstoppable, massive, massive, massive tune. How did this progression come about? How did you end up creating something that is completely unique to anything I've heard in recent times? How did this all come about?
Well, first of all, give thanks, man. Thank you very much for the positive words and for understanding the project vision, you know. First of all, it's vision one, because it's just the first part of what's about to come. That's why it's also only four songs, you know. I wanted to take time to introduce the this kind of music that we're doing right now, instead of giving people just 12 new songs, just giving them the song step by step and bring them closer to the vision step by step. So it's not me alone really working on this project. Like
no,
all
not,
the projects,
yeah.
I always have my team. But obviously here it's Cali P and Tekka. And Tekka is a producer who is originally from Germany, who is based in Berlin. And he's a producer I've been working with over a long time. One day I just came across a remix that he did, which was with Migos, and I listened to that and I really felt it. It was like fresh, and I heard the rhythm and the way they were singing over it. True, it was a remix. I was like, yo, I need to link Tekka and ask him if it's possible for me to just make my own song on that rhythm, you know. And when I linked him for that, he said, yo, basically, yo, he has a lot of rhythms like that, because lately he was inspired by this whole trap movement and he kind of found a new sound. And that sounded so interesting to me that I just went straight to Berlin, you know. And we're going to just step by step give the people, in an unusual way, instead of putting out the album, just putting out these songs by four and make these videos and work with the visuals, like really promote my African clothing and bring it in a fresh way, you know, for the youths to really say, yo, man, this, yeah, I feel that, you know, that is us.
And that absolutely comes across in it. If you look at tracks like Life Lessons, for example, you can hear the sort of trap synths going on in the background, but then you've got...
Exactly the song I'm talking about. That was the one I heard was the remix with Migos in that time.
Ah, you know? Excellent.
And from then, Life Lesson came on that rhythm, you know.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. I love it so much. It's great. It's hard to know what to call it. I mean, it's for me... You can only describe it as world music, really. It's not, you can't pigeonhole it into anything particular. Is that a fair description, do you think?
I think so, you know. I mean, world music is very a very wide name, you know. But I think it fits still, because at the end of the day, that's what it is. It's bringing the world together with different styles of music. And what I want is my music just to be fresh and nice. I don't want to make the same music I made 5 years ago. That's obviously already out. So we're trying to bring the thing on the next level. And I very much love to work with the younger generation. And I observe the younger generation. And like me, I was in music since at a very, very young age. And what I loved at the time was not sometimes exactly the same as maybe the elders would love,
yeah,
you know. So right now, if I see the younger generation coming with a new style, with something that to me sounds strange in the beginning, instead of being against it, I want to find a way to work with it and together, you know.
Do you know what? You've kind of hit on something really important, and also another thing that really stood out to me there, because with the overriding sort of trap influence that's in there, you've done something unique in terms of the, as you say, young people will listen and go, yeah, I can hear trap or drill in there. But therefore, by grabbing their attention, you're putting across such a positive message as well. Is that important to you with your music?
It is my mission with my music, okay. You know, as Lyrical Fire, like I definitely see my child, my daughter listening to my music, you know, and I see people of all ages basically listening to my music, and I want them to get something from it, definitely. So it's positive vibes I'm pushing, and when I hear the whole trap vibes, and like what you said, the dark also in the visuals and everything, I don't dislike it, you know. I really like the art, so I want to use this art and show them that we can do the same thing, that same vibe and everything. Now, instead of telling somebody, yo, shoot this, I would tell them, yo, put down your gun. Because really and truly, that's what I want to tell my young brethrens and sisters, you know.
Conscious music isn't really pushed. We have a major problem with that in the UK. But that also kind of reflects the Rasta community in the UK. It's a belief system and a religion and philosophy which is very suppressed in this country, especially by the establishment. You travel all over the world. Is that an issue you see globally, the suppression of sort of the Rastafari belief and the movement, or is it more unique to the UK, do you think, with our establishment?
Definitely there is places like also the UK, but also other places like even in Europe, or to a certain extent even in Jamaica or in the US, where a lot of Rastaman getting ready to even leave. Like I've been in Africa, I see a lot of Rastaman there building up their places. So like that's one thing I see. And then of course it's about what you want for yourself. If you've been living in the UK, you know, as a Rastaman, or even having a family, I believe that it's not the easiest way you chose, you know. So definitely I can believe that a lot of people, because of that, then decided at some point, yo, we are going to make a move, you know, because, you know, if I'm struggling in England or wherever in the world, let me go home to the mama land and do what I can do there, you know.
Yeah, no, of course. And it's really frustrating, not least with regards to Rastafari, but also with regards to conscious music, how suppressed it is, because it's like the world as it is at the minute is sort of politically and socially, we're not in a good place. The world's pretty messed up at the minute, and it's like it for me, it's logical that we need conscious music really more than ever. We're not in a good place, but do you think it's a particularly bad point in history, or and is there hope that we can change things?
I believe that more than ever, you can just see very clearly and without even hiding it who is in the power of media, of news, of spreading their ways to the people straight across the world. You know, that is what is out right now. These are the people who get their points across, and this is what shocks the whole world somehow. I think that there is a lot of strong people, that there are a lot of conscious, awakened people everywhere in the world. Now, the thing is, they don't show them. They don't give them space, because it's a war. You know, this is a spiritual war, and they're afraid of this kind of people to step out too loud, get too strong. That's why it's more easy to have music playing sometimes that really has no sense, you know, to keep the people in that nonsense, you know, instead of having them starting a revolution. We just have to stay strong, don't give up. And I know that there is a lot of people out there feeling those vibes, feeling those vibrations, working in the right direction, and over time to come, you know.
What did you want listeners to take away from this first part of this sort of major project? What did you want listeners to take away from Vision One?
I just want to make fresh music, you know. I want to make good music. This is really what I'm motivated to do, you know. So I take time making good lyrics, taking care of these things. And like right now, when I'm in the studio, I just want to have a good time, know that I make music that move me first of all, that, you know, and then transmit good feelings, you know, transmit good vibrations, be natural and real, you know, just sing about myself and what is happening in life right at that moment, because that's the best way you can really put it out with not even just the words, but also the feeling, whereby people just feel it like that. And that is where the whole mystic, natural mystic in the music happens, you know.
For listeners at home, when can we expect part two of this project? When's it coming up?
I can say very soon, very soon. We're going to put out a video, a visual for Love It When You Hold Me, When You Hold Me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're going to make a proper video for that, like Bodies, you know. And very soon after that, I can say maybe March, beginning April, definitely, I think it's already going to be time for the second part.
Excellent. I cannot wait, because I can't even begin to imagine what you're going to do with part two. So it's going to be brilliant. It's such a pleasure to speak to you, Calipi. It really was great to speak to you. Really, really interesting.
Likewise, and thanks very much for the good vibes, you know. We're very happy, like, to see, like, the feedback we're getting everywhere in the world with these just four songs. It's very great, and that was basically really what I wanted, you know, because when we had all these nice songs, I was like, yo, I feel like if I'm just going to put out a new album with so much songs, it's kind of going to go under, you know. And like this, people have time to listen to the four songs, you know, it's not too much, it's not not enough, it's just right to get some music and spend some time with it, and then some new ones are coming, you know.
That's a brilliant point, and that's a brilliant sort of way of thinking, actually, yeah, because that is exactly what you have done. Calipi, thank you so much for joining me.
Respect, big up, big up, big up. Blessings to each and everyone out there.
Trust me, if you get one piece of music this month and next, then you need to make it Vision 1 by Calipi. It is absolutely staggering. And on that note, here is a track from the EP. It is When You Hold Me. Calipi, When You Hold Me. Love it when you hold me. I really love it when you hold me.
Hey, baby girl, tell me, are you there? Can I speak with you? Tell me, do you care? There is all this love I wanna share. So take a seat and get prepared. I know they don't wanna see me and you, but don't be scared. Cause in this there is just me and you, son, just let them be. We gonna find the happy end to our story. Cause you're my one and only. I love it when you hold me. I'm feeling that this love control me. I love it when you hold me. And you forget the glory. I love it when you hold me. I'm feeling that this love control me. I love it when you hold me. Wanna treat you good, you forget the glory. Princess, I said, you're the very best I ever felt. So very hot every time I melt. And when you're passing by with your heavenly scent.
And that's it. Episode 12 of Topple Uncaged is done. I'd like to thank my fantastic guests this week, the indefatigable Emily Apple. Follow her on Twitter, it's at Emily Apple. And the staggeringly talented Calipi. Follow him on Twitter, it's at Calipi Music. As always, behind the scenes, I'd like to thank the love of my life, my queen, Nicola Jeffrey. Follow her on Twitter, it's at Nicola C. Jeffrey. As always, my man in the booth, Gav Paws. Follow him on Twitter, it's at Paws with a Z Radio. And my in-house singer, it's Ray Star Music. Follow her on Twitter, it's at Ray underscore star 113. Last but not least, the Canary. Thank you for uncaging me for another week. Otherwise, I'm done. I'm off to bust some moves to Calipi. See you next Sunday.
Uncaged.